Hiawatha Rag by the much-missed Mike Daniels and his Delta Jazz Band. And now, here on BBC Radio 3, it's time for Kevin Legendre and Jazz Lineup.
Hello, I'm Kevin Legendre, and today on this special edition of Jazz Lineup, I'll be celebrating one of the great soundtrack arrangers of our time, Lalo Schifrin. We'll also hear a brand new interview with Lalo recorded recently at his home in Beverly Hills. Here's one of his best-known tunes. It's the theme to Mission Impossible. Lalo Schifrin is a modern-day musical icon for whom the term Mission Impossible has a double meaning. The theme song from the groundbreaking TV series is his musical signature, along with scores for films such as Bullet and Dirty Harry. Yet Schifrin's life has been a mission accomplished. The 84-year-old Argentinian was one of the first South American musicians to make it on the post-war American jazz scene, conduct some of the world's greatest classical orchestras, and create a huge body of work that has more than stood the test of time. This, then, is Lalo Schifrin's life story, the epic journey of a creative, adventurous mind with a special relationship to sight and sound. Lalo Schifrin was born in Buenos Aires in 1932, a time before the military leader Juan Perón came to power. His father, Luis, was the conductor of a chamber orchestra, and his uncle, Robert, was a cellist. When, as a boy, Lalo expressed an interest in music, he took lessons with a teacher from another great musical family.
Oh, I studied with Enrique Barremon, Daniel Barremon's father. He was very, very difficult. He was tough. For instance, if I made a mistake playing, and I was a child, he had a pencil. Not too hard, but he very unpleasant vibration. It was not torture, but that's the way he was, and I ended up playing quite well.
But classical music was not the only thing that interested him. Lalo started listening to local radio, where he discovered American jazz stars such as Count Basie and Duke Ellington, just as he was also studying composers like Ravel and Stravinsky. Gradually, Schifrin started to play jazz, largely teaching himself from albums he bought from a sailor in the Merchant Navy who helped him to defy the Perón government's prohibition of Western music.
Later on, about when I was 16, I had friends, not even in the same school, but we met at parties, and these friends also started to like jazz. They became aficionados. Some of them started to, by ear or self-taught, one trumpet, another trombone, another drums. We had no bass, and we played only in our own houses. We didn't want to play for public. That would be out of the question, but it helped us. It helped me especially. Everybody has different tastes. My taste developed for bebop, what we call Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker. I understood that the harmonies, well, of course, melodies and rhythms were very peculiar. When people say, oh, Dizzy Gillespie plays too many notes and it's out of, he plays anything. No, I said, there's nothing that he plays, not even one note, that is outside the harmony. My father saw my inclination for jazz. He said, that's no music, because if you don't write it or you don't read it, because it was improvised, that's no music. So that created a little tension between us. I would say that it was my rebellion.
Although he was falling in love with jazz, Schifrin continued listening to and studying classical music, and his next teacher was Andreas Karalis, a Russian emigre of Greek origin who was the director of the Kiev Conservatory who had fled the Stalinist regime. Soon it became clear that Schifrin would have to go abroad to keep developing, and he won a scholarship to the Paris Music Conservatory in 1952, where one of his teachers was the legendary Olivier Messiaen. But he didn't like dormitory life, and in order to cover the bills of a rented apartment, he gigged in the city's jazz clubs by night.
There was one club called Club Saint-Germain, and not other clubs, the Taboo. The same way you give an audition. I didn't even know I was giving an audition. I went to play just jam sessions without expecting being paid. And the musicians started liking, and I started to become friends with French musicians. In Buenos Aires, they were good musicians, jazz musicians, older than me, and I played with them too, but these are much better because they had the opportunity to go to jazz concerts. American musicians were playing concerts. Even Dizzy Gillespie came.
All of the energy of those jazz clubs and those concerts by legends like Dizzy Gillespie that he was privileged to witness in Paris fired him up. So when Lalo returned to Buenos Aires, he formed a 16-piece big band based loosely on the groups led by Count Basie and Dizzy Gillespie. The band became very successful, touring in South America from Chile to Brazil. The indigenous rhythms of these countries would provide an inspiration to Lelo and inform his latter work. The great Argentinian poet José Luis Borges said luck and destiny were synonymous, and the two certainly combined when Lelo's idol Dizzy Gillespie came to Buenos Aires as part of a State Department tour in 1958. Schifrin and his band went to the concert, and then they did a private gig for Dizzy in a small theatre. Events took an extraordinary turn.
When we finished, Dizzy, instead of going with his wife, he came to the stage and he said, "Who wrote these charts? I did. Would you like to come to the United States?" This, I couldn't believe it, but this is truth. This is absolutely truth. I couldn't believe it. I said, "Did I hear well?"
He certainly did. Schifrin took Dizzy at his word and moved to New York in 1958. But the trumpeter was a major star who was constantly on tour, so the young Argentinian couldn't play with him initially. To support himself, he worked with the commercial Latin dance sensation Xavier Cugat, but also, as he had done in Paris, started to frequent the city's jazz clubs, such as the legendary Birdland. Schifrin finally connected with Dizzy, who gave him a major break in his career. The bebop legend asked him to compose new music for him. All of Schifrin's knowledge of jazz, Latin and classical music came into play.
The first thing I wrote for him, it was a suite of music about himself. It was Gillespiana, like Gillespie. You know the Villalobos, very famous Brazilian composer, classical. He wrote Bahianas Brasileiras, means a Brazilian tribute to Bach. Bahianas is, and that I wrote Gillespiana. Bahiana, Gillespiana. You see, a tribute to Dizzy. See, my classical training helped in jazz. I don't see any difference. It's all music. And it helped me. And it helped everything.
I'm Kevin Legendre, and I'm celebrating the music and life of the great Lalo Schifrin. Let's dip into Lalo's amazing archive of film and television music. From the mid-60s, this is the theme to Mannix. The theme to Mannix, written by Lalo Schifrin. Let's continue the amazing story of the life and music of Lalo Schifrin. As a member of Dizzy Gillespie's band, Schifrin's stock rose rapidly in American jazz circles, and he was asked to write arrangements for other stars such as Stan Getz and Sarah Vaughan. By 1962, Lalo was sufficiently well established to lead his own orchestra, featuring some of Dizzy's top sidemen, such as saxophonist Leo Wright and trumpeter Clark Terry. They brought to life Schifrin's fine original tunes like this one, Pegajoso. We'll be right back. Schifrin continued to tour with Dizzy's band, and when they were on the West Coast, a chance meeting at an airport would change the young Argentinian's life. He met a man called Clarence Evans, who was the agent of the very successful organist Jimmy Smith. He liked Schifrin's work on Gillespiana and told him to have lunch with him when they were back in New York. Evans had connections with the music department of the film studio MGM. He asked Schifrin if he wanted to write the score for a movie. The young man gladly accepted.
Just to try me, they gave me a low-budget movie called Rhino. I would say my second movie in general, but my first American movie, which is the beginning of my career as a film and television composer. And that was it. One of the movies I did, Cool Hand Luke, with Paul Newman. This is the only time that I go on location. They wanted me to feel the atmosphere. The director, Stuart Rosenberg, wanted me to feel the atmosphere of the place. And right there, they were still shooting. And I see it. I had to hear the music in my brain. And this is what happens all the time. When they show me from the screen, if I don't have a screen, then I write classical music or jazz, abstract. When it is abstract, it's different. When it is concrete, coming from the screen, that's different.
I'm Kevin Legendre, and I'm celebrating the life and music of Lalo Schifrin. Let's go to another new chapter now in the story of Lalo Schifrin. In 1966, he was asked to write the theme for an innovative new television series about a team of elite spies with high-tech gadgetry. The show and the music did not self-destruct in 5 seconds. In fact, Mission Impossible became a cultural phenomenon.
First, they gave me the screenplay. The music and movies have something in common, rhythm. And I cannot get the rhythm from a screenplay. But once they showed me the whole thing, I got the suspense and the tension and I wrote a theme that it was used a lot. Bruce Geller, the producer, and he wrote it, he was in charge of everything. He directed. Bruce Geller says, I want you to write a theme for the main title. They were to do the image to my music. It was like a backwards. He says to me, I want you to write a theme that should be very exciting. And if the audience in the kitchen having a soft drink, and the television set is in the living room, if they hear that from the kitchen, oh, Mission Impossible is playing. So that's what I did. Some movies, when there's a detective or private investigator, or especially contemporary, I use a little bit jazz rhythms because that reflects the rhythm that the detective has in solving their investigations. And that's why in Bullet, I had a kind of jazz rhythm and very simple starts, like Ravel's Bolero, starts with a simple melody, well, the same melody. Ravel's Bolero is one flute, a solo, accompanied with a snare drum, very soft. And then toward the end, start getting bigger and bigger. That's what I did in Bullet. Instead of one flute, I start with one guitar, electric guitar, but soft. And the accompaniment is very soft. And of course, there is a famous chase. I told director Peter Yates, I told him, because he wanted music during the chase. No, you have to orchestrate, I said to him, with sound effects, because the music and the sound effects are going to crash against each other. At that moment, stop the music, which is more effective, and start the sound effects. And then I'm going to bring back the music when he finally beats the bad guys. And then the music becomes bigger and bigger and bigger.
Thank you.
It's impossible to imagine the cars and stars of Bullet, Steve McQueen of course, without Schifrin's highly atmospheric music. He was particularly good at scoring movies because he'd seen a lot of plays and films in Buenos Aires as a youngster and was fascinated by the relationship between sound and image. Lalo Schifrin was able to write music to match the moods and twists and turns of a story on the screen. Over the years, Schifrin scored more and more hugely popular films and TV shows, from The Cincinnati Kid to Enter the Dragon and Mannix, and claimed his place in the film composer pantheon alongside the likes of Jerry Goldsmith, Quincy Jones, and Ennio Morricone. You can also hear the huge influence that Lalo has had on the Beats generation, the electronica and hip-hop artists who've either sampled him or drawn inspiration from his amazing touch with strings. We're talking about people like Portishead, Wu-Tang Clan, and Cinematic Orchestra. Throughout the 70s and 80s, as jazz became more electric, Schifrin took an interest in fusion, but he did so from the point of view of somebody who loved Stravinsky and Charlie Parker, not necessarily somebody who loved rock music. Thank you. Weather Report's Birdland, performed by Lalo Schifrin and the London Philharmonic Orchestra in 1996. Today, Lalo Schifrin continues to work with some of the best orchestras in the world, from Vienna to Tokyo, and his passion for music, at the age of 84, remains undimmed. Many musicians have blended jazz and classical music over time, but Schifrin does so with a sense of vivid imagery that resulted in some of the greatest movie music of all time. In 2012, the Grand Lyon Film Festival bestowed upon Lalo Schifrin the Honour of a Lifetime Achievement Award, and that prestigious accolade says much of the enormous contribution that he has made to film and music over a career spanning six decades. Lalo Schifrin believed what his compatriot Borges said about destiny and luck. They have coincided on his amazing journey through sight and sound, making him a true magnum force of modern music. I'm Kevin Legendre, and it's been an absolute pleasure celebrating the life and music of the amazing Lalo Schifrin. I'm going to leave you with one of his greatest musical bullets. It's 1971's Dirty Harry.
Like Clint Eastwood said in Dirty Harry, go ahead, make my day. Do you feel lucky?
Schifrin's Dirty Harry from the 1971 film of the same name, ending jazz lineup. The programme was presented by Kevin Legendre and produced in Glasgow by Sushil K. Dade. And if you'd like more information on jazz lineup, go to the programme page via the Radio 3 website.
70th season on BBC Radio 3.
They give around 400 concerts a year.
The sheer variety of repertoire that we have to face on a daily basis is what's kept me here for the last 25 years.
In over 50 towns and cities across the UK.
We went up to the Isle of Skye with a wonderfully appreciative audience from the island.
I think the strangest place we've done a concert was in a velodrome.
Reaching an audience of millions.
There's thousands of people listening at home in the radio.
People can sit at home and tune into concerts if they can't make them themselves.
Join the BBC orchestras and choirs for a whole day of live concerts and recordings. Pass the Baton starts at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. Now it's time for tonight's Opera on 3. We join Donald MacLeod at Leeds Grand Theatre.
There's one compelling reason to catch Opera North's new production of Benjamin Britten's Billy Budd, the singing of Roderick Williams in the title role. For liquid ease, pearly grace and pure line, I don't think I've ever heard this music delivered more elegantly. So wrote Rupert Christensen in The Telegraph about this new production by the Irish director Orfa Thelan of Britain's operatic version of the novella by Herman Melville. Roderick Williams is joined in the triangle of principal roles by two other equally distinguished British singers, Alan Oake as Captain Vere and Alistair Miles as Claggart, and by the chorus and orchestra of Opera North, conducted by Gary Walker, making his debut with the company. Well, you'll find photographs of the production on the Opera on 3 pages of the Radio 3 website, where you'll also find a synopsis and a link to the free downloadable Radio 3 Opera Guide on Billy Budd. Britain's biographer Paul Kilday points out that for the first time since Paul Bunyan, when he'd collaborated with W.H. Auden, Britain was working on Billy Budd with a librettist whose talent matched his own. E.M. Forster, working with Eric Crozier, had the task of adapting Herman Melville's short story for the opera stage. It's easy to see why this intense psychological drama, with its head-on confrontation of good and evil, its many ambiguities, and its hero, a young sailor who radiates beauty and goodness, would appeal to Britain. Set, as it is, aboard an 18th-century naval warship, Billy Budd obviously has an all-male cast. I wondered if the director, Orfa Thelan, felt that, as a woman, she had a different perspective on the opera.
It's an incredible thing to work with over 60 men on a stage. That's an awful lot of testosterone in one room. And I think having a woman to direct it has actually helped to dilute that. I like to think that this Billy, and maybe it is because I'm a woman, is more thoughtful and sort of introspective and more concerned with the psychology of the characters rather than the war. The most important thing is the journey that Captain Vere goes on.
The director, Orfa Thelan. The opera was originally in four acts, but Britain revised it a decade after its 1951 premiere to the two-act version we'll hear tonight. The drama's framed by a prologue and epilogue, in which Captain Edward Fairfax Vere, the commander of the British man-of-war HMS Indomitable, looks back as an old man on the events that have haunted him ever since, when he was tested and found wanting. In the prologue, he sets those events very precisely for us. In the summer of 1797, during the Napoleonic Wars, and shortly after the mutiny at the Nore, where